Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello, good evening, and welcome to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the show that brings you conversations that matter. And today, continuing on an ethical theme, assisted dying is what we'll be debating on the show, a for and against position from a rabbi and a Christian doctor. For more from the show, make sure you're subscribed to our newsletter. You can do that by visiting our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Very close as well to the public launch of our first online apologetics course, Confident Christianity. You should be hearing all about that next week, so look out for that next week. You can also find more resources at our webpage, ways to support the show. If you're able to support us, we'd love to send you my ebook, Why You Can Believe, Lessons Learned from Over 15 Years of Hosting This Show. Coming up later on Unbelievable as well, Mark Vernon is going to be talking to me about Dante's life and legacy. This month marks 700 years since the death of the medieval writer, whose Divine Comedy has shaped so much Christian art and imagination. And Mark has written Dante's Divine Comedy, A Guide for the Spiritual Journey. He'll be telling us about that a little later on. Right now, though, time to introduce my guests as we debate assisted dying.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today, we're asking, should people of faith support assisted dying? Now, the House of Lords will be debating a new bill on assisted dying this coming month. Baroness Meacher's bill is reigniting the question of whether people with terminal illness should be allowed to end their own life with the help of medical professionals. Now, the bill would introduce similar legislation to that of Oregon in the USA, where assisted dying and euthanasia has been legal for some time. The British Medical Association recently officially dropped its opposition to assisted dying, and according to a recent poll, three quarters of the British public back changes. However, a smaller proportion of MPs are convinced. But what about the religious and ethical questions that arise when it comes to euthanasia and the choice to end a life? Well, joining me on today's show are Rabbi Jonathan Romaine. He chairs the Religious Alliance for Dignity in Dying and advocates for changing the law to allow people to end their lives under the right circumstances. Dr. Mark Pickering is chair of the Christian Medical Fellowship. That's an organization which currently opposes the assisted dying bill. And Mark believes it's ethically wrong for medical staff to participate in deliberately ending life, and that the Bible's view of the sanctity of life means that Christians and people of faith generally should stand against it. So we're going to be hearing from both Mark and Jonathan in the course of today's show. This is very much a current trending topic at the moment. And perhaps we'll start with you, Jonathan, just to give a sense of how you've been involved up to this point in these issues and what your role with Dignity in Dying is when it comes to this particular bill.
Well, I started off against assisted dying for all the sort of usual reasons, so to speak, that people of faith in the past, I stress in the past because it has changed enormously, but my views began to change because the more time I spent in hospitals and hospices, yes, of course they do wonderful work. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They're just fabulous heroes, the people who are there, especially the hospices. But there are some people who they cannot help, they cannot reach. And there are also some people who are not so much dying in pain, but dying in great distress or indignity because of the nature of the illness they've got. And I just thought, this can't be right. And you know, time after time, people would say to me, oh, I just wish I would die. Or every time I wake up in the morning, I'm so disappointed I'm still alive. And I thought, in those cases, and those particular cases, why cannot somebody who is already dying terminally ill be allowed to gently let go and say to God, thank you very much, it's been a great life so far, but I really don't want to endure the last few weeks. So I got involved in Dignity in Dying and actually became a board member, and then I'm now vice chair. And as part of that, I also founded the Religious Alliance for Dignity in Dying, which links together people of faith. And that's both at the sort of clergy level, so we've got rabbis, priests, vicars, imams, so in other words, covers all faith, but also very much laity, again, of all faith. Just to say that you can have faith and be in favour of assisted dying in the very particular circumstances, which is the threefold formula of being terminally ill, mentally competent, and actually wishing it for yourself. And that's where I am now. And we feel we've got, you know, there are arguments against, and I'm sure Mark will give them, but there are many religious arguments for. Right. Whereas beforehand, I think people thought it was thou shalt not, and it was a blanket no from the religious. Now I think it's accepted there's a diversity of views within the faith communities.
I mentioned the British public, the poll at least that was commissioned, suggested about three quarters are in favour of the law changing. How does that map out, as far as you can see, when it comes to people of faith and particularly clergy, whether they be Jewish, Christian or something else? How do you see the general, you know, recognition of this and thoughts changing?
Well, I have to say I've been bowled over by the polls. You know, I expected it to be a sort of 50-50 split, but the last poll that was taken, I think it was Populous in 2020, showed 84% of the public were in favour. So, you know, astonishingly high. I mean, in political terms, that would be an absolute, it wouldn't be a landslide, it would be a sort of volcano. But what was really fascinating is the religious element. And they broke it down and they found that actually 82% of people of faith were in favour. And how do you define people of faith? Well, it's not just people who sort of got an airy-fairy belief in God, but these are people who go to their place of worship, church or whatever, at least once a month, if not more. So 82% of people of faith. Really, and what astonished me about that was not only how high that was, but it was in contrast to the sort of position of the hierarchy, like, you know, the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Catholic Bishop of Westminster, and how, although the hierarchy says absolutely no, the membership, the faith-based membership, has a very different view.
Yes, and it's interesting because I suspect there's a similar split between MPs and their willingness to change the law and what appears to be the, you know, what the polls suggest about the British public. But we'll come back to that. And I suppose there is that question of, should we just go with the majority thought on these sorts of issues? But Mark, let's introduce you first of all. Tell us a little bit about your role, first of all, with Christian Medical Fellowship and how they've been responding to this proposed bill and indeed what the British Medical Association have recently decided on it.
Great. Thanks, Justin. Pleasure to be here. Today it's like playing for my favourite football team because I've been an avid, unbelievable listener for about 3 years. It was one of the first podcasts I ever managed to listen to, and it's still my favourite, so it's great to be here.
Oh, brownie points to you for mentioning that.
You're welcome. So, yeah, I'm the chief executive of the Christian Medical Fellowship. We're an organisation of doctors, nurses, midwives and students, over 4,500 within the UK and Ireland. And I've been involved with them since I was a student for more than 25 years, but I've been their chief executive for the last 2.5 years. And our job is what we call it, uniting and equipping Christian doctors and nurses to live and speak for Jesus. And so it's basically helping them to integrate their faith with their medical, nursing and midwifery practice or their studies. So part of that is member support with the different areas that we do, you know, conferences and that sort of thing, literature. But it's also helping to educate them, to think through the issues that they deal with, and also to engage with and protect the environment in which they work, both for Christian clinicians, but also for vulnerable populations. So that's why we do quite a bit of public policy as well. So we're often engaged in debates such as these. And we work with a number of partner organisations, the Care Not Killing Alliance, and their new medical wing called Our Duty of Care, There's also a new all-party parliamentary group on Dying Well, and a number of us work together in different ways. So the debates over assisted suicide and euthanasia are not new. You know, they've been debated many times. I think it's more than 15 times in UK parliaments. So the fact that Baroness Meacher's bill is coming back this year is nothing new. Proponents will often say, oh, it's never been debated properly, we haven't heard the arguments. That's just not true. They've been done to death, as you might say. But it's one of those things where people will feel they haven't been heard because they haven't changed the law yet. And that's why things keep coming back in the same fashion, whether it was Lord Joffe's bill or Lord Falconer's bill or the Maris bill in 2015, which was defeated very heavily. And I think in terms of CMF's involvement, I think many of the arguments against assisted suicide and euthanasia, they work almost equally well if you're religious or not religious. We'll obviously come onto some of those as well, but I think there are particular reasons why people of faith, certainly people who engage with their faith, are more likely to oppose assisted suicide and euthanasia as well. And then I think very often the polling that you hear about is often very vague. People are asked sort of sugary questions about choice and control and compassion. And so most people think, yes, of course I support choice and control and compassion and dignity at the end of life. But it's when you get down to the brass tacks of what that actually means, people start to think, oh, there are actually problems in that. And they're the things that it'd be great to talk about today, obviously.
What do you make, and what has Christian Medical Fellowship made of this recent, I don't know if it's the first time really, but that the British Medical Association have officially dropped their opposition to assisted dying.
Yeah, and the way that you've phrased that is exactly what the headlines have said. You know, doctors drop opposition to assisted dying. It sounds like it was really emphatic, whereas actually it wasn't. There were 302 people debating, 149 voted for neutrality, 145 voted against. There were 8 abstentions, so it's 49-48% split, and actually a majority of those in the room did not even support that vote. So it was very, very, very close, and it was based upon the poll that the BMA did back in February 2020. 29,000 member responses. It's a really excellent poll and very good data to have. And you know, all credit to DID and to Jonathan and his team. They did come out on top of that with 40% of the respondents from that BMA survey saying that they were in favour of law change and 33% against. So there clearly is a split amongst the medical profession. But what you often don't see from that data is that that data was skewed significantly by students who voted more for assisted suicide, those who've never looked after patients, then retired doctors who will never again look after patients. And that was the sort of thing you see through that. Whereas the people who deal day in, day out with end-of-life conversations, palliative care physicians, very strongly opposed, GPs, oncologists, geriatricians, they're much more likely to be opposed. Mm. So as in many situations, there is a split, but the closer you get to death and working with death, and the concept of assisted suicide and euthanasia, the more you tend to recoil from it. And that's something that you really don't see in the headlines.
Yeah. I'd be interested in your response to that, Jonathan, but also perhaps just to bring us up to speed with Baroness Meacher's bill. I mean, Mark says these issues have been done to death. We've had Lord Falconer's bill and others in, you know, relatively recent past. What is there anything new about this bill, or is it just putting it on the table again in a very similar fashion to before, Jonathan?
Well, two comments. In one respect, Mark's right. In one respect, he's wrong. I mean, to be honest, Mark, you began to sound a little bit like Donald Trump saying, "Well, I did win the election after all." And actually, he didn't. He lost the election. And similarly, the BMA, I mean, you know, yes, you're right, the vote itself was very close on the day, but they were representative, and they were basing their vote on the survey, which, as you said, was massive. Well, every single doctor in the country had the ability to participate, and the majority, and it was quite a clear majority, voted either for neutrality or in favour. So, you know, you can fiddle a little bit with the figures, but there's no doubt that there's something significant going on within the medical profession. because if, as you say, there was such concern, then those in favour of either changing the law or the BMA being neutral would never have got anywhere near the vote that they achieved. So I think you have to say there is a shift amongst the doctors, whether one likes it or not. But you are right in saying, yes, we've debated this before. And, you named all the main bills, Joffe Bill, Faulkner Bill, and now the current Meacher Bill. The only thing that's a little bit different is that they've tightened it up. Because when the Joffe Bill came along, it was a little bit vague, and people were, I think, rightly worried about the safeguards, because, you know, there's always the case of, vulnerable individuals. And so in every single bill, the safeguards have been made stronger and stronger. So, for instance, in the Faulkner Bill, the person had to be interviewed by two independent doctors separately, just to check that they really did want it. Now, in the Meacher Bill, it has to have a judicial oversight. So you can't just get a friendly doctor. The whole process has to be overseen by the courts and by the judge to really ensure that all the boxes have been ticked and that the safeguards are really robust. So there are slight changes, but yes, the substantial issue, does someone have the right to bring their own life to an end if they are dying in pain? The arguments for or against are probably still the same.
And Mark, I'm sure you can understand why there would be people in favour of this change. It's always distressing to see a loved one, and indeed for anyone themselves, to go through that kind of an experience. But why historically, and in your view, you know, do most working professionals in this area still oppose actually people being able to do that?
Well, I think it's because, like I said, with those polls of public opinion, they're very strongly in favour when you talk in vague terms and you talk in a sort of utopian idea of how it will all work when, if it goes as Jonathan hopes it would go. But whenever you start to talk about the problems, you start to talk about some of the challenges, talk about some of the evidence of how it's really gone in other countries, then that support often does tend to fall away a little bit. And Jonathan didn't mention actually that there's been a 10% drop in public opinion. That 2021 survey showed, I think, 73%, whereas normally it's quoted, as you did, Jonathan, in 2020 as 80-odd%. So we don't hear people talking about that drop in that. But I think it's, the classic arguments against are that this is basically an autonomy-driven exercise. It is people saying, you know, I want that choice, I want that control. And of course we understand that, you know, people don't like to have pain, but as Jonathan said, that's not the majority of people. You know, we often hear people talking about dying in terrible pain, but thanks to the hospice movement, very few people in an advanced healthcare system die in significant pain. There are a few, but it's a few, and the vast majority is about things like autonomy. In Oregon in 2020, I think it was 59% of the people who opted for an assisted suicide, they said they felt a burden to either themselves or to their family and carers. And a lot of that is really driving the concern that we have that the autonomy of a few will lead to the erosion of autonomy and the burden and the actual duty to die for those who are vulnerable. And then we've seen in many other places the laws extend. So Jonathan and DID will often talk about how in Oregon things haven't changed significantly. That's true. Federal law in the US prevents them going for euthanasia, so that's not because Oregon is anything special. But whereas in Canada, you've seen a massive erosion of the safeguards in just 5 years. We talk about terminal illness, and that was part of the original Canadian provision. But it's been struck down in actually 3 years, from 2016 to 2019. Now that terminal illness provision has been struck down. So any disabled or chronically ill person in Canada can and often does opt for what they euphemistically call medical aid in dying. So there's no assurance that the UK won't go that far. In fact, Dignity in Dying are just one of six organisations in the UK and the Crown dependencies that are all campaigning for some form of assisted dying. And all of the others go significantly beyond Dignity in Dying. You know, the terminal illness is a purely arbitrary question. And you know, people like Paul Lamb, who was a very high-profile campaigner. He was in pain for 30 years after a road traffic accident. He wanted to have an assisted suicide. Dignity in Dying did not support him. He would not have been eligible through the Meacher Bill. And we would often want to say, well, to Jonathan, where is your compassion for people like Paul Lamb, who had the same desires, but you would not put them in with your bill? And why not?
Yeah, feel free to answer that, Jonathan. And I suppose there are those who see this as a sort of slippery slope, thin end of the wedge and so on. And those who are concerned about places like the Netherlands, where there appear to be cases of people effectively being euthanized almost because they just feel deeply depressed and that sort of thing. And is there any particular reason why we should stop at terminal illness rather than other reasons people may want to end their life?
Sure. And I mean, you're right to quote the Netherlands, but you're wrong to sort of compare it to what we're proposing here in England, because it's a totally different system. They started off from a different position, different rules. It's like comparing football and rugby. You know, there they had a much broader definition right from the word go, whereas Dignity in Dying has always been adamant you have to be terminally ill. So you're not depressed, you're not going through a bad patch, you're not chronically ill. And yes, you're right, it's very sad when you've got someone who is chronically ill, like Paul Lamb, and they've got sort of a long, difficult period ahead of them. But we're talking about law rather than feeling. So law has to be, needs clear definitions so that judges can say, well, this coincides with the law and this does not, and it falls outside its parameters. And that's why Dignity in Dying goes for someone who is terminally ill, as specified by the doctors, as opposed to being in long-term pain, because that is something that can be legislated upon, whereas the others cannot be.
Well, could I just ask back to that, Jonathan? So if you get your way and the Meacher Bill passes, and then My Death, My Decision, Humanist UK, the other campaign groups say, well, that's a good first step, but now we want to push on for, you know, people like Paul Lamb and others who are still in pain. You know, their autonomy demands this. Our compassion demands this. Will you actively be campaigning against those bills? Will you be saying, no, we have sympathy, but we're not going to campaign for you? Because, like you said, it's about law. It's not about feelings. That's what we've always been saying, and you've always been painting us as the uncompassionate ones. But when you're in that position, how will you respond?
I will drop out of the debate at that point because I don't think that's viable.
You'll step back and let your friends push it on from where you've got it started? Because unless you're prepared to speak against them, it really does, you know, it really does give the lie to the position that you're holding now.
Okay, well, I won't lie then. If I'm asked, and I'm very happy to come back in Justin's programme if the bill does go through and becomes law, and say, well, I'm very pleased that we've got the current law, terminally ill, mentally competent, but I don't want it to go any further. And so if I'm asked, I will say I'm against the law. And by the way, of course, the law won't change. And if it does, it would only be because 300 or 400 MPs decide that it should. So I find that pretty inconceivable, to be honest.
I mean, great question back to you. Why should that be inconceivable when it's happened in Canada in just 3 years after the law came into operation? What's so special about the UK? And, you know, we talk about public opinion, which you do put a lot of store by, but whenever you hear your phone-in programs after there's been a debate about it, you'll often have a patient coming on talking about how difficult their end-of-life situation is, or a relative. Very often they're people with Alzheimer's, they're people with chronic disability, or somebody phoned in straight after a discussion recently and they said, oh, well, you know, if I get to that point when I'm just staring at four walls and I can't wipe my own backside, you know, I want to have assisted suicide. But of course, none of these would be helped by your law. And so you've got this massive tide of public opinion that doesn't understand that what you're proposing does not go far enough. In My Death, My Decision, they are the people who came out of Dignity in Dying because you don't go far enough.
Exactly. In other words, they were not satisfied with the limited stand we took, and they broke away. And we didn't say to them, oh, well, don't worry, stay with us. We'll do a first step and then we'll move on to you. We said, I'm sorry, you cannot be part of our organization because this simply isn't what we're aiming for.
Because you understand that it does not go well with the public and with Parliament.
You don't want this either. So we're on the same side here.
But have you ever put that to MPs? You know, do MPs understand, and do the peers in the House of Lords that you've been lobbying, do they understand just how much the public opinion is actually for going further than what you're campaigning for?
I'm not sure that's correct, by the way, that the public opinion wants to go further. And certainly MPs are very well aware of it. And if this bill passes, it'll only be because MPs will feel reassured that there is a red line. And that's the whole point. That there is a sort of an end that is measurable, and we can say to someone, well, yes, it's very sad that you're going to live on in pain for 20 years, and we're going to do everything compassionate to try and help you, but you are not eligible for assisted dying because that's just not part of the Act, and the law is the law. And
that's, you're almost sounding like me and my colleagues, Jonathan, but you've always said that we're terribly uncompassionate for saying exactly those same things.
I'm not saying you're uncompassionate. I'm saying that a more compassionate response is to help people who are terminally ill and dying anyway. So, and I think that's what's so crucial about this debate, by the way, and where it differs. And this is where perhaps many of the other people, maybe not yourself, in the religious community who do oppose assisted dying, is that they maybe get a little bit confused or bemused or befuddled by the comparisons with a suicide. And the crucial difference is that for most people who commit suicide, had they not done so, they would have lived on for maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 years. With assisted dying, they are dying anyway. So that's a very, very different scenario. They are dying anyway. It's just that they want to let go a few weeks earlier.
Can I sort of get then on the record in a sense then, Jonathan, but you're saying that it is unethical and potentially, you know, not something that any religious person should support to enable someone who wants to die for any other purpose to take that decision, that should not be left
Correct.
In their
Yeah.
own hands.
Yeah. Very clear red line.
Okay. This is very helpful to me because I think a lot of people do conflate all of these issues, and they, you know, and as Mark says, a lot of people, I think, just think of dignity in dying as being, I want autonomy about when I end my life, where I end my life, you know, in whatever circumstances I choose. And obviously that's not where the organisation is coming. You're worried though, Mark, that actually this is simply the first staging post in something a lot more liberal in the direction that Canada has gone and elsewhere. I do want to kind of draw us into the sort of specifically religious issue of this, of course. And Mark, perhaps just before we go to our first break, you could explain why, you know, even at the level of simply assisting people who are already terminally ill to die, you believe that even that level of assistance actually, you know, your Christian faith doesn't allow you to participate in that.
Well, I think, you know, this idea that all religious people oppose assisted dying, we've never said that. That is a myth that's been perpetuated by Dignity in Dying and their colleagues, because for years, whenever people have spoken out against, you know, physician-assisted dying and assisted suicide, often they are religious people, and that's been a means to dismiss them, to say, oh, you're religious, we're not, we don't have to listen to you. So that's a myth that's been perpetuated. And now, suddenly, Jonathan and his friends have come along and, you know, suddenly discovered, in quotes, that there are religious people who actually do support them. And now we have, you know, say, oh, yeah, we've discovered it's not all people, all religious people. Of course it's not. But I think what we do find is that those people who engage seriously with their faith are less likely to support assisted suicide. Now, you know, Jonathan has talked about his new religious alliance for Dignity in Dying. It's not really new. It's an old recycled alliance for religious people. It used to be called Interfaith Leaders for Dignity in Dying. And a couple of years ago, I was looking around to say, well, they must be active. I'd like to engage with them. And there was nothing. You know, a couple of out-of-date website pages. It had basically fallen away because it's the same four people, Jonathan, Rosie Harper, George Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, and Desmond Tutu from South Africa, and they're the only four figureheads really there. And there are so few leaders, mainstream leaders. There are a few people more on the fringe and more towards the liberal end of different faiths. You know, there's an imam who supports same-sex marriage. You know, that's not exactly mainstream Islam. And that we find this, I think, in all of the things that I've seen so far, these religious people who support assisted suicide, it's generally sort of using the same secular arguments about autonomy and compassion, then saying, oh, well, surely God likes this. But actually, it's not seriously engaging with faith and the arguments from faith, because I think there are probably three main arguments that we could use that are consistent with the mainstream faiths and that also overlap with some of the main arguments against assisted suicide. And I'm sure Jonathan would like to come back in a bit on what I've just said, but then hopefully we can look at some of those three main arguments.
We'll go to a quick break and I'll allow Jonathan to do that in just a moment's time. We're talking about assisted dying and we're joined today by Jonathan Romain, a rabbi, Mark Pickering, who is chair of the Christian Medical Fellowship. And we'll continue to discuss the ins and outs of this new bill proposed by Baroness Meacher on assisted dying here on Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's edition of the show. We're talking about whether people of faith should support assisted dying on Unbelievable today. The House of Lords due to debate, again, I think it's the second reading of the assisted dying bill from Baroness Meacher. And one person very much in favour of this is Rabbi Jonathan Romain. He chairs the Religious Alliance for Dignity in Dying. I'll make sure there's a link to them from today's show. He believes there are circumstances under which people with terminal illness should be allowed to end their lives. Dr. Mark Pickering from Christian Medical Fellowship is speaking against this proposed change. And just in that last section, we were starting to dig into the reasons why Mark believes as a Christian we shouldn't be supporting these kinds of changes. He doesn't think that the religious alliance is really as strong as perhaps people make out. Jonathan, it's the same figureheads as have been, you know, put forward in the past on these issues. What's your view on this in terms of the actual religious case, if you like, for this kind of assisted dying?
Well, I was a bit amused about Mark's answer, because instead of giving you a positive reason why Christians are against assisted dying, he just talked about the numbers of those in favour. And I'm also a bit bemused that he considers people like the former Archbishop of Canterbury and Desmond Tutu as not, quote, seriously engaging in their faith. But, I mean, you know, I don't want to have a sort of ding-dong about a religious warfare. You know, there are good arguments on both sides. I just feel that from a religious perspective, if somebody is dying already and they request to let go of life early, in whose interest are we keeping them alive? For what benefit are we forcing them to suffer on? And, you know, there's nothing sacred about suffering. There's nothing holy about agony. And I just simply don't understand why, if someone wants it, they shouldn't be allowed it. Now, I get entirely that Mark and many people like him wouldn't want it. Fair enough. Great. And let's hope you live a long and healthy life. But I think it's almost a bit arrogant to say somebody else has to suffer on in pain because of, you know, your principles. It's their life, it's their death. We all hope for a good life and a good death. And why are we stopping them having it? To me, that's just sort of so obviously the humane, the moral, the ethical, the religious response.
As a rabbi then, Jonathan, just to be really clear on this, you don't feel that there's a sort of anything wrong with human stepping in, intervening to bring an early death to someone, that doesn't transgress any sort of particular teaching from Judaism about the sanctity of life, and that those sorts of decisions are ultimately in God's hands rather than in ours.
Number one, of course, assisted dying is nowhere mentioned in the Bible. It's a very much a modern issue, so it's not really part of biblical or later teachings. And number two, there are suicides in the Bible, and nowhere. There are four suicides, in fact, and nowhere does the Bible actually condemn them. So, you know, things have changed enormously in that respect as well. And you know, not, and there is division amongst rabbis. So, So the answer is no. There is no inherent problem with someone who, as I say, if they fit this particular category, terminally ill, mentally competent, wanted of their own free will, there doesn't seem to be any particular objection. And of course, the God barrier, this is only in the hands of God. We transgress that every single day in all sorts of birth and death, don't we? You know, we bring into life test tube babies who, if God had his way, would never be born. We see someone with a heart attack and don't let them die, facing God's way, so to speak. We give them a heart transplant or a blood transfusion. So we're constantly interfering, if you like, and in both the end and the beginning of life. We're playing God. And I don't say that in a negative way. We are using our God-given talents to help people and benefit people. And this is another example of where we can help someone in pain.
Even if it's actually in the actual outcome of that is the person losing their life before they would have, naturally died a death themselves. But I understand the principle. You're saying whether it's helping someone to live further or ending their life earlier, it's about the principle of, I suppose, compassion and doing what is right as far as you can see.
And by the way, Mark will know about more than this more than me, but if you are a strong Christian and you believe in the afterlife, you just get to see God earlier, don't you?
Okay. Well, Mark, let's pass it over to you.
You do indeed, but you're passing from death to life is a pathway to judgment and then to either reward or punishment, as the Old Testament scriptures are very clear, Daniel 12 verse 2 and also the New Testament scriptures as well. So I think yes, for Christians or for someone who is engaged with their faith, then the approach of death need not have fear in it. It can be actually the gateway to something they're looking forward to. But the vast majority of people that you're supporting this for, they're not engaged Christians, they're not observant Jews. Very many of the times they're agnostics and atheists and that sort of thing. And so we can't really, as people of faith, say to them, oh, sure, this is okay, it's all right for me, I'm going to put this law in place because I think I'm all right, but actually I've got no assurance about you. Now, what I heard from you, Jonathan, was really no religious case at all, just a bit of a sort of fumbling around saying, well, rabbis are divided, that I don't see anything definitely against it in the Bible. Talked about four suicides. Yes, there are four suicides, and there's no teaching that says thou shalt not commit suicide, etc., etc. But you look at those suicides, like King Saul. None of these are things that are looked up to in the Bible as a great and glorious death. It's not like the noble suicide of Greek philosophy. Saul was slain on the battlefield, and apparently had to get an Amalekite soldier to finish him off because he was in pain at the time. That's just like the ignominious end to a life lived in opposition to God. So nowhere is it actually promoted. But I said that I'll make three main arguments from a faith perspective that chime with the secular arguments. And the first one is that overemphasizing autonomy for a few will lead to increased vulnerability for the people with the least autonomy. Now, God has given us rationality and autonomy, and a reasonable degree of that is really good. But whenever we're demanding our rights, then that leads to duties on others, and that very much affects the vulnerable. Now, of course, Jews and Christians hearing me, they'll think, well, what's he talking about? He's talking about sin. When we push our autonomy to going beyond the boundaries that God has set or going beyond what's good for other people and for society, that is sinfulness. Non-religious people might know it as human nature, the fact that we all tend to be selfish and look out for number one. But that's one reason why I think Christians and Jews and most people of faith should be really, really careful and really, really suspicious of these great claims that, it's all about autonomy. Autonomy is the driver. No, we're actually very suspicious about unbridled, unrestrained autonomy. And that's a secular argument that chimes with a faith argument. Secondly, about safeguards. Jonathan again puts this utopian vision with these lovely rose-tinted glasses of how wonderful it is in Oregon, where everything works smoothly, the laws don't extend, society does not become less compassionate as we get used to killing people, suicide doesn't become normalized. But again, we know as people of faith that that never ever works. I think it was Francis Spufford that said about humanity's propensity to mess things up. And you know, again, we use that, we know that as sin or human nature, but everything always goes wrong. You know, communism, socialism, they're great ideas on paper, but once you get real people involved in them, they fall apart. And exactly this is what we see with assisted suicide. You know, we know as people of faith that the safeguards we put in place, very soon, you know, people will push against them. Safeguards will become barriers to access. We've seen that in many jurisdictions. Now people are saying, oh, this is a barrier to patient access, something that was put in as a safeguard. That's the second thing. And then again, suffering. The third one, suffering is not just hopeless. You never see in Dignity in Dying's material anything good that could possibly come out of suffering. You know, Jonathan says that about suffering, there's no sanctity in suffering. Well, actually, there can be great purpose in suffering. You know, all the best literature, poetry, philosophy, and of course so many things in faith, they come out of a place of suffering. That's where we often learn. It's where we often reflect on our life, on the life of those people around us, the example that we give of fortitude in suffering. Dignity, by the way that we deal with suffering, that can have a brilliant effect on the people around us. So who is it for? Well, it's for all of us. Because in the times I've worked in hospices, you see people coming in hopeless, uncontrolled symptoms, oh, doctor, let me die. All understanding, but when you actually get on top of those things, when you help them to see that it's not as hopeless as that, you know, family relationships can be restored, many good things can happen at the end of life. My big worry is that for the people who've always been in control, who want to, you know, take their own life and push their own autonomy, they'll put in place a legal framework which A, will enable them to avoid talking about those things, but it will actually make the people who are vulnerable be a burden and request those things when actually they wouldn't do that.
Thank you so much. There's three things to respond there to, Jonathan, and maybe we'll just take them in order and we can sort of spend some time going through each one. What about that first one, which is effectively, Mark, relates to the problem of sin, that we overemphasize people's autonomy, that leads to a pressure on the vulnerable, and there's a sinful aspect of this idea that we all have to be, you know, decide for ourselves everything around us, and that we therefore fail to see the effects that has on other people. Your thoughts on that point?
Yes, and that's true in many situations, but not in all situations. And there are times when we do want and value and cherish autonomy, which is why we are created in the image of God, and we've got that creative spark, and we can do things that other people cannot do. And we're not automatons or robots. Certainly one's own autonomy shouldn't impact on others. You know, the old, you're not allowed to shout fire in a crowded cinema, that sort of thing. But when your autonomy is affecting you, and you're the one dying in pain, I think you do have the right to say, I've had enough. I can't go on. I would like to pass away. I would like to get a life-ending prescription from my doctor. I think you do have the autonomy. So we'll just have to disagree on that one. And as for the safeguards, well, okay, it's a valid point. You want to make sure that the law works and doesn't affect anyone negatively. So the answer then is to work with Molly Meacher or any other bill and say, well, these are the safeguards that we need to put in place. This is what we need to do to make it as watertight as possible. So that we can not necessarily want that option for ourselves, but we can know that if that option is taken up by other people, it is done in the safest possible way. And as for suffering, well, I guess you're going to straight disagree with you there. Yes, of course, suffering can lead to great poetry and all the rest of it, or even discoveries. But actually, for most people, suffering is pretty horrible. And again, if you want suffering, fine. But if someone says, no, thank you, I do not want to suffer, and particularly as I've only got a few weeks left, and particularly as, you know, I can't move my limbs or my brain is befuddled, I'm not really going to write War and Peace in the next few weeks. then I don't see why we should insist that they suffer. I just don't get it.
I'm interested then, before Mark comes back, Jonathan, as to why you don't support those who are simply suffering but without necessarily a terminal illness in view, why you don't support their death as well. They're will, you know, if they could end their suffering, why not in their case?
Purely for the very practical reason that it would be so hard to measure, and that's exactly when the vulnerable or abuses could creep in, and it's precisely because I want to make sure that there are safeguards and protect the vulnerable that you can only do it by having a very, very clear line in the sand. And the law anyway demands that, because the law can't fudge. It has to have a very clear cliff edge where it does apply to certain people and circumstances and not to others.
So to some extent, it's a practical argument that you simply can't legislate for it as easily, obviously, in that scenario. But responses on all three of those there, then, Mark, yes, we should be careful, but actually that autonomy is good in certain circumstances, and Jonathan simply can't see any reason why you wouldn't grant that kind of autonomy as long as it doesn't impact other people.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing just where the reasoning is all falling apart here, because, you know, a clear line, what's clear about 6 months? What about those with 9 months or 12 months? Those with motor neuron disease who they know they're going to die, they don't want to suffer, you know, down to that last 6 months. What about the 2 or 3 years that gets them there? There's nothing that means 6 months is magic period. Prognosis from doctors is often way out. People that we thought would die in 6 months can be alive sometimes 5 years later. And you've said that suffering is hard to measure. I would agree. Suffering is totally subjective. But because you're pushing this narrative of fear and hopelessness, then rather than, I mean, you know, as a rabbi, if I came to you, you know, suffering in some way psychologically, you know, would you say, yeah, it's tough, maybe you should kill yourself? You know, of course you wouldn't say that. You say, well, let's see if we can see it differently. You know, let me tell you a story. You know, let's see what we can do. Can we put something in place to help and support you better? You've said that our own autonomy shouldn't impact others. That is absolutely true. And we're simply making the case, as we've often made, that pushing autonomy for a small number, generally, of people who are determined, the people that we see about in the news who go to Dignitas or campaign for you, that will change the law, but they will affect everyone. It's going to impact everyone, so that every GP, every NHS hospice doctor would then have to say, you know, here are the options before you, and have you thought about assisted suicide? Doesn't matter if you've never thought about it before, I'm duty bound to raise this with you because it's available on the NHS. And then there are people who live their whole lives in unrelievable suffering. You know, there are people with severe personality disorders, some of whom I look after.
I don't understand why you're fighting this when you don't want to give them the right anyway. So why are you criticising me for giving them that help when you don't want to do it either?
What a great question, Jonathan. It's because I know that we need to have compassion for people in suffering. These people with personality disorders who feel a chronic sense of emptiness, suicidal thoughts day after day. We don't say to them, yeah, your life really sucks, there's not much we can do, we should help you to kill yourself. And because we can show compassion to them, then we can show compassion to people with chronic illness, disability, terminal illness. That is what the hospice movement does. Now, Jonathan, you often tell the story of what changed your mind, the person in a hospice who was doubled up in pain and, you know, nothing could be done for them. And you say that was one of the stories that changed your mind. And I'd be interested to know, what did you do at that point? Did you call for a nurse? Did you find out if a doctor had, you know, prescribed the right medication? Had they been referred to palliative care? Or did you just think, there's nothing that can be done, I must join Dignity in Dying and campaign for a change in the law?
Oh, well, the simple answer, I think they were in a hospice, actually, not a hospital. And I certainly tried to comfort them, but it was pretty inadequate. I certainly spent a lot of time with the family, who were greatly distressed. But, you know, what's really interesting about this discussion is I think, the disconnect between theory and practice. I've often been invited in the last couple of years by church groups, you know, to speak about this. And many of them have raised the sort of objections that you've raised, which is fair enough. And then at the end of it, and it's quite clear that I'm sort of losing the argument, so to speak. And then at the very end, I sort of say to them, okay, and this has happened 2 or 3 times, and now, All right, fair enough. But let me just ask you one final question, I say to the audience. If it was you personally suffering with whatever it is, motor neuron, multiple sclerosis, and you were dying in pain, would you like that option of assisted death for yourself? And you know, every time, every single hand in the room goes up. So I think that's what it's about. It's just giving people the option. It's not for everybody, it's certainly not for you, but I think it is appropriate to give people that option if they are dying in pain.
Jonathan, when I'm late for the airport, I wish that I could drive at 100 miles an hour to get there in time. I'd want that option for myself, but I don't take it because I know that pushing my autonomy would impact on the safety of so many others.
It's a nice reply, but it's not relevant.
Really? No. Many people who are suffering in the end of life or at any time of life think, yeah, it would be nice. And actually, that might be something I would take. But so many get to that point later and they think, actually, I'm so glad I didn't take that option when they have had the good palliative care that's on offer. Let's not forget that 320 people die every day, I think it is, without good access to palliative care. You know, I'm really glad that you've said how wonderful it can be, but we've hardly scratched the surface of what good palliative care could offer across this country. And so many of the people who will campaign for you, whose stories you'll use, they've had bad deaths in their family. That's not because palliative care can't help, it's because it wasn't available to them.
Well, it's a clear difference that, Mark doesn't want to give people that option, that choice, that right, and I do. So we're not going to agree on this because you want to close down options, I want to open them up. And by the way, what's really interesting about Oregon is that the palliative care carers who were against assisted dying when it was first introduced now not only are on board, they work hand in hand with Oregon. And of course, the whole issue of end-of-life care has had enormous publicity as a result. And actually, the level of investment in palliative care has shot up as a result. So actually, it's not a matter of either or. It's a matter of both and. And there's no reason why we can't give people the option of assisted dying for those who wish, but also raise the level of palliative care for those who want to carry on to their last moment. I think they should go together.
Where is the data for that, Jonathan? I've not seen any data about investment in palliative care going up. Yes, publicity may go up, but at the end of the day, I don't think there's any reason why investment in palliative care should go up, because palliative care is there to deal with the problems that can't be helped otherwise, and you're taking the head off it by basically saying, look, we don't need to invest in further palliative care research. There are these people we can't help. Let's just give them assisted suicide. I'd love to see actual data on where that investment has gone up as a result of law change and been sustained.
It's very clear we're talking about a limited number of people. I mean, if you want data, I think the latest figure for people in Oregon who opt for assisted dying is 0.69%, 0.69% of all deaths in Oregon. So it's less than 1%. So we're really talking about a limited number of people. And most people will want to carry on, struggle on till the last moment. And, those are the people we should be helping as well, just as much.
And it has risen steadily year on year in Oregon, as you know, but you still haven't given me any data or places to find data about further investment in palliative care, and I'd really like to see.
I didn't mean to miss that out. If you ring up Dignity in Dying, they will give it to you. I mean, I don't have that at my hand. And you're certainly right, the number of people has gone up of deaths in Oregon, but from a very low base. And in 2019, which is the only figure in my head, it was 191 people. So we're talking about astonishingly low numbers.
One unbelievable listener, Sebastian Melmoth, got in touch with me just ahead of this discussion and forwarded me an article, came out last week, I think, in The Spectator by Joel Zivot, questioning whether assisted dying is in fact as painless or dignified as those in favour it make out. The article points out that the same chemicals are often used in death penalty executions, and he brings up the case of one particular person who was executed in America with a chemical called pentobarbital, which caused his pulmonary Edema, I may be mispronouncing this.
Edema.
In Oregon, 4 in 5 assisted suicides have employed pentobarbital or its close relatives. If a post-mortem examination were to be performed on a body after assisted suicides, it's very likely that similar pulmonary edema would be found. Basically, the lungs fill with fluid, they drown. And it doesn't look, it looks peaceful on the surface because the person can't physically show any sign of distress, but their point was actually when these postmortems would be done on execution, people have been executed, there obviously was a lot of pain and distress involved in that. Are you satisfied, Jonathan, that this is actually a dignified way of dying?
Well, first time I've ever heard that. I've spoken to a number of people who've taken their husband or wife to Dignitas in Switzerland, and no one's ever reported either distress at the time of death or any problems with the post-mortem results afterwards. So that's just like, well, where did that come from? So, okay. No. And
as
frankly,
I say,
if that was true, there would be a major outcry.
Well, there was a major outcry, actually, because it was in The Spectator last week, and Jackie Davis, the chair of HPAD, was debating Joel Zivert on The Spectator podcast, so well worth having a look at that. I think it's actually a really good question to have raised, because we don't have, to my mind, good data, and why would you do a post-mortem on people who've had an assisted suicide? You don't need to know the cause of death. They've killed themselves. But I think there are really legitimate questions there. Now, of course, in Oregon and proposed in the UK, there'd be oral taking of those medications. That's a different mechanism to intravenous, and some of it may be to do with the intravenous route. But I think if you look at a place like Canada, where again they use similar drug combinations, and actually Canada, where you've got the option of both oral and intravenous, hardly any are oral because people realize that it takes longer. There are more side effects or more visible side effects. Very often people who start with an oral assisted suicide in Canada, they will convert it to intravenous. There are even flowcharts by the Canadian Association of Medical assessors and providers to say, look, if you're going to go oral, put in an intravenous line just in case you need to convert it to intravenous. And then in those situations, and the vast majority of Canadian deaths, I think there is a very strong correlation with the situation that we see in illegal execution in the States, using similar drugs in a similar intravenous way. And as you've said, are they simply paralyzed and unable to show the distress that they show? I think it's a really interesting question. And, it's not for us who have concerns to demonstrate the safety of it. It's for Jonathan and his colleagues to demonstrate that they've been through all of this. And the very fact that Jonathan's never even heard of that, I think, is very significant.
Well, we'll come back to and allow you to respond to that in just a moment's time, Jonathan. We're going to go to our final break and give you a chance to think about that while we're on the break. We're talking about assisted dying. Should people of faith support it? In favour of that, Rabbi Jonathan Romain joins me from the Religious Alliance for Dignity in Dying, opposing this change, Dr. Mark Pickering of the Christian Medical Fellowship. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. Final part of the discussion coming up here on Unbelievable between Dr. Mark Pickering and Rabbi Jonathan Romain on assisted dying. Still to come, though, on the show, Mark Vernon will be talking to me about Dante's life and legacy. It's 700 years this month since the medieval writer who wrote The Divine Comedy passed away, and he'll be talking about the influence of that writing and his own book, Mark's new book, Dante's Divine Comedy, A Guide for the Spiritual Journey. Still to come tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, Olivia Amate is Emma Fowle's guest on The Profile. In 2018, Olivia was appointed as Executive Director for Elim Pentecostal Churches in the UK, becoming the first woman and person of colour in its history. So you can hear that tonight at 8 p.m. or on its own Profile podcast. And next week here on Unbelievable, continuing this mini series series of ethical debates. We did veganism last week, assisted suicide this week, next week debating abortion law, especially in light of Texas's controversial new so-called heartbeat bill outlawing abortion after 6 weeks. Joining me for that are Stephanie Gray, a leading pro-life advocate in the US, along with the Reverend Bromley McLenahan, a church leader in the USA who advocates for a pro-choice position. So that should be a really interesting conversation at the same time next week. I'll be giving out the ways to get in touch with us towards the end of today's show as well. Don't forget, you can find more from Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And if you are listening on podcast, do rate and review. It helps other people to discover the show as well. Concluding our discussion today on assisted dying and whether people of faith should support it, I've been with Rabbi Jonathan Romaine and Dr. Mark Pickering on the show today. There is links from today's program to Dignity in Dying and the Religious Alliance there. You can find them at dignityindying.org.uk/religious alliance. That's the group that Rabbi Jonathan Romaine chairs. Christian Medical Fellowship is at cmf.org.uk, and I'm sure you'll be able to find your way to links on their thoughts on assisted dying as well. But just in that last section, Mark was outlining some of his concerns that were shared in this Spectator article that was mentioned by Joel Zivot, in which he claims that actually there are, you know, potentially it's not a painless way to go, and there's not as much dignity involved because of the association there is with these chemicals that are used also in lethal executions and so on in the US. I mean, I know you haven't had a chance, obviously, to look at this article yourself at this moment, Jonathan, but I guess this does raise significant questions about the way that we do this, you know, the practical effects of this. I think in the end, I think what Mark hinted at very early on in the show was when you're at the coalface of doing this stuff and actually administering the drugs and those actual crucial end of life decisions, when you're not simply saying yes in a sort of neutral environment, it sometimes feels different. Does that make sense? And it's not as simple a question, because there's that thing of, do I really want my last memories of my loved one to be me force feeding them this, you know, cocktail of barbiturates to end their life? People don't think that far ahead, I suppose, when they're at that moment and so on. So any thoughts on that as to how we, if you are in favour of people being able to do that, that it isn't a distressing way in which to end someone's life in the end?
Firstly, I'm very much at the coalface as a congregational minister of religion, whether it's visiting people in hospitals, hospices, or seeing them dying at home, and also counselling their families. So I really do know what life and death and dying and dead bodies is about, which is why I take the attitude that people should have that right to choose for themselves. The phrase you used, and I know you just threw it out, is so totally wrong when you said force-feeding their relatives with barbiturates. The whole point about assisted dying is that you do it yourself. And assisted dying doesn't mean that somebody else gives you an injection or gives you the pill. You get the prescription from your GP and then take it to your chemist and then get it. So the assistance is only in that the state or the medical system will allow you to do it and give you the means. But you're the one that has to actually do it. You're the one that has to take the pill in your hand and swallow it with a glass of water or whatever. So it's not somebody else, a doctor or a relative, doing it to you at all. So that's a very, very false image.
I'm not sure it is, Jonathan, because people in Oregon talk about having to mix up 100 pills into this horrible syrupy paste and yes, help their relative take it, not force feed them. But it's not a simple pill. You know, this idea that there's one pill that you take and you slip away is just false.
Well, I'm not sure if that's true, to be honest. I haven't actually been in the room. I don't know, have you?
No, but I've read the reports from people and relatives who had.
Well, the answer, and I can quote you plenty of examples where the person slipped gently away. I think if you have a concern, which is fair enough, then the answer is to get involved in the legislation and say, well, look, if this is going to happen, this should happen in this way and not that way, and we should be aware. And that's a good point, you know, we should be aware that at every stage, what happens is in the best interest of the person concerned and in the best possible way. So they do have, and that's the whole point of an assisted dying, they do have a gentle and peaceful death. That's what we want for all our, for everybody.
We are drawing to a close. So I'm going to ask you both to sort of make your final thoughts on this. Perhaps we'll start with you, Jonathan, and then Mark, just to give us a sense of why you believe, and there's lots of people who listen, both religious and non-religious, to The Unbelievable Show, but specifically why you think that, you know, people of faith should not be concerned, in your case, Jonathan, with this particular legislation coming through the UK Parliament. And then Mark, your final thoughts as well.
Yes, assisted dying is not for everyone, and I'm not even sure if I would want it for myself. But I do know that I want people and myself to have that option, so that if they were facing the very last weeks or months of their life, and they were in incredible distress, pain, however it's defined, then I would want them to have that right to gently slip away. And I wouldn't want to force them to live on in pain and in distress. And I say that as a human being, but also as a person of faith, with everything that faith means to me, means that I should assist someone, in other words, give them that permission to do so if they so wish, and if they are terminally ill and mentally competent. It seems to me a religious response to give people that option, provided that they are the right safeguards to protect them and their families, and that's what all the clauses of the bill are all about.
Thank you, Jonathan, for being part of the show today. Mark, your final thoughts.
Thanks very much, and thank you, Jonathan, for engaging with a really good discussion. I really appreciate that. I think my point would be, yes, compassion. We're all for compassion. We're all for being with suffering people, for helping them, for assisting the dying in different ways. That is what palliative care does. That is why Cicely Saunders, a Christian, who launched the palliative care movement, did it, because she saw people who were not well served, and she thought, there is a better way. I'm so glad that she didn't give in to the council of hopelessness and despair and just say, maybe we should legalize assisted suicide. But there's so much more that needs to be done. I talked about 320 people, I think it's a day, dying without good palliative care. It may be a week, but it's a lot. And there's so much more that we can do. The NHS needs good funding for that as well. Because at the end of the day, we are crossing a massive line by legalising this. There is one massive safeguard against the dangers that we've talked about, and it is the current law. The prohibition against killing is the safeguard. As soon as you start to chip away at that and say, well, a little bit of this, 6 months here, mentally competent here, you are... I don't like the term slippery slope, but you have pushed yourself off that ledge, and it is very hard to stop it. Like I said, 5 organisations in the UK and our Crown dependencies are campaigning to go further than dignity in dying is. So there's no way that that's going to be stopped. It hasn't been stopped in other countries as well. Maybe I could just finish by quoting the late Chief Rabbi Lord Sacks, very eloquent opponent of assisted suicide. He said this in 2006, "It is the physician's responsibility to heal, not harm, even if the patient requests it. Despite Judaism's strong emphasis on human choice, free will, and personal responsibility, we believe there are certain things we may not do, even out of great compassion." And I think if we fail to heed his words, we will be in a very sticky situation, as they are right now in Canada.
We'll leave it there, but thank you very much for both of your engagements and for the way you've carried out today's discussion on these important issues. Again, links to both the Religious Alliance in Dignity in Dying that Rabbi Jonathan Romaine chairs, and Mark Pickering's Christian Medical Fellowship as well, and some of their resources from today's show. But for now, Jonathan and Mark, thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
Let me know what you thought of today's discussion. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via our social media At UnbelievableJB is where I post on Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is where we post all of the latest show content, and you're welcome to leave your comments there as well. You can find me over on Instagram and TikTok too at Justin.Brierley. And thanks for Keith, who actually got in touch via my Instagram to say, my wife and I and four kids live just outside Nashville, Tennessee. Just wanted you to know, Justin, really enjoy listening to Unbelievable since stumbling across it after my wife and I took a trip to the UK in 2018. We wanted to return to the UK with our four kids and had our bags packed, were literally ready to leave in March 2020 when everything was shut down because of COVID. But we will be back over just as soon as this craziness allows, this time with the kids in tow. You do a great job hosting Unbelievable. Appreciate the even-handed and gracious style of facilitating a discussion between your guests, who often have differing points of view. This type of forum for discussion is very rare these days, but we need more moderators who value open discussion as a means to uncover truth. Thank you very much, Keith. Very lovely of you to get in touch and leave those encouraging words. If you want to leave words for me as well, encouraging or not, as I say, you're welcome to get in touch with the show. But we're going to leave feedback to next week's show. I'm sure we'll have plenty of feedback both to the vegan debate of last week with Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones, and also today's debate on assisted dying. Welcome your thoughts. But before we get to all of that, my guest for this section of the program is Mark Vernon. He's going to tell us about who he is, but he is currently the author of a very recent book, Dante's Divine Comedy, A Guide for the Spiritual Journey. It's 700 years since Dante died, and we're going to be finding out from Mark who he was, what impact his writings had, and what it can say to us today, 700 years later. Mark, welcome along. Great to have you with me.
Thank you. It's nice to talk about these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, consider me an uninitiated Philistine, all right, when it comes to Dante. So you're very much starting from the beginning. Tell us, first of all, who Dante was, what, you know, his body of work was about, and particularly the impact that the Divine Comedy has had culturally and historically.
So he lives, as you say, 700 years ago in the 13th century, dying then. And I mean, one way of thinking about why that is significant is because it's sometimes called the first industrial revolution now. He lived at the time when things like mercantilism, trading, was beginning to take a form that matters to us now. So the precursors to capitalism, society was changing. In terms of how human beings think about themselves, you might say, it's the earliest days of the Renaissance. So, for example, he's a friend of Giotto, and Giotto paints these human figures that have an inner life that feels a bit like our inner life when we look at them. So he comes at this really seminal moment in terms of the emergence of what we now call modernity, and writes this great epic, The Divine Comedy, in the last part of his life when he himself was in exile. The Italian peninsula was a whole series of city-states often at war with each other, and Florence, his hometown, fell into civil war around the 1300s, and that led to him being sent into exile. It seemed like a complete disaster for his life. He was already well known both as a poet and as a politician, but it's out of this catastrophe that over the next 20 or so years before he dies in 1321, the Divine Comedy is born. And hence the famous opening line midway through the journey of our life. He actually says our life. He wants to draw us straight in. He wakes up and finds himself in a dark wood. And that launches what's not just the kind of midlife crisis and how he recovers, but a complete transformation of his perception of himself, his times, and God.
So give us a sense of what the book actually is for those who have not read it, as I'm sure many listeners won't have had a chance to read it. What actually is the story that gets woven in The Divine Comedy?
It is one of these books which everyone's heard of, and You've undoubtedly come across references to it too, particularly the first part, the Inferno. He journeys through hell, right down to the floor of hell, stands right in front of Lucifer, and then begins to find a way out, first of all, through Mount Purgatory, which is a process of change where his sight and perception expands, and then into paradise, where ultimately he stands before God face to face. So it's this journey right across the cosmos as particularly the medieval imagination understood it. But he's very much writing, I think, for the future, for our times as well. And he senses that the modern period, it's not just anachronistic to talk about modernity, because he actually is the first person to use the word modern. So he's sensing times are changing and feels that we need to re-establish how we connect to divine reality if things aren't to go very, very wrong. So it's not just his personal crisis, but the crisis of his times, and I think still ours, which is why it still speaks to people now. But it is quite a labyrinth. I mean, my book, in a way, is to try and say, look, if you want to get into this thing that you've heard of, and you maybe even have heard that it's one of the, I'd put it in the top three bits of genius Western Christian literature, you know, after the Bible, as it were. So if you're serious about Christianity, for some, it felt like this to me, you know, it's kind of like a bit of a mountain that I've got to try and climb. I hope my book helps people find a way into it. It's so important because it's not just, you know, of interest. It really does change you when you embark and engage with it, which is another reason why it's difficult. It's not just complicated because there's lots of characters in it and so on. It's difficult because it's asking you to change if you're going to try and keep up with what's being conveyed. You know, it's one of these works which you could say is inspired in that sense. It channels so much more than itself.
So would the average reader be able to sort of literally pick it up and sort of understand it? Or is it the kind of thing where you really do need a guidebook, really, to understand what someone from 700 years ago is trying to convey through this specific type of literature?
I think it does help to have a guide. I mean, you know, Dante famously himself has a guide. He's met by Virgil in the dark wood and then eventually is met by Beatrice as they go into paradise. So there's no shame in having a guide. I mean, it's very much part of grace, actually, to have a guide. You know, these things are always meaningful. Any good modern translation, I mean, if people want to read a specific recommendation, I recommend the one that's in the Penguin Classics in English, translated by Mark Muser. And it has a good number of notes so that you can, as it were, read a section and then look at the notes, and he explains any characters, gives you some sense of what's going on. And then you can start to let the text speak to you more and more. Yeah. So I do pick up some sort of guide.
And before we come to your own guide, which obviously I wanted to talk about, this particular book, you've written a guide for the spiritual journey. How would you say what Dante has written has sort of made sense of your own journey? Because I know you've been on a significant kind of trajectory, different things. You've had your own sort of crises of faith in the past. You've described yourself as an agnostic at various points, Mark, and then sort of come back to something which you think does connect you with the fundamental kind of truth of Christianity and so on. To what extent has Dante been part of that journey that you've gone on yourself?
Very much part of it. I, you know, a bit like perhaps many people, I kind of wanted to read it, tried to read it, half read it, but then it was actually the thing that really brought it to life for me, in that mix of my own particular journeys you describe, was my own psychotherapy. Actually, I went into psychotherapy to try to understand more about what was more frightening me and, you know, perhaps blocking life for me and so on. And I then began to understand how the descent, which Dante literally undertakes into these dark infernal regions through the famous circles of hell, is about encountering, well, your own darkness too, and how that can become very preoccupying and can keep you stuck and quite literally blocks out sight of wider reality. A Christian idiom here would be something like taking up your own cross. There's a strange, wonderful thing, but thing you feel very cautious about saying too, because it's a serious undertaking, that our suffering actually is often the way that we find the path to light. It's not that you kind of sidestep it or it just dissolves or it goes away. Following the way of the cross, going on the descent, is the precursor to the ascent. And so he gave me kind of courage, if you like, that this darkness that I felt I was facing, this confusion, wasn't all a sort of big mistake that somehow I had to get over, but didn't know how. It was actually the path. It was actually the route. And then seeing how he conveys it helped me to work out what that might mean for me now. So it was very much part of the kind of the turnaround for me over time. You know, this all takes a bit of time, but it was very much part of that turnaround for me.
Who is the kind of person who might benefit, you think, from picking up this book, whether or not they've heard of Dante or read The Divine Comedy? Where do you expect this to be someone who perhaps is feeling like a kind of disconnect with the world, with God, not sure where they find their place in it, that you believe The Divine Comedy could be a help in them guiding that kind of a person?
Yeah, it's a book that takes you into the subtleties of life and shows you how that's where the limitless lies. You can, as it were, go through life almost as if it's a kind of flat land. And it can be, you know, pleasant enough, has its ups and downs. But, you know, maybe every so often you wonder what an artist sees that perhaps you don't feel you quite see. Or, you know, conversely, in more religious writing, I don't know, you might read someone like William Blake saying that when he looks at the sun, he just doesn't just see a guinea shining in the sky like a coin. He sees the heavenly hosts crying, holy, holy, holy. And you think, well, what are they on about? And Dante's book, I think, opens up reality in that way. You know, it's in poetry, and so metaphor and image. He sparks your own desire. He makes you want more from life, and that is what leads to you being open to receiving more. So it's certainly for the Christian who wants to take their life in more expansive directions. But I think because his focus is so much on perception, it's about anyone also too who wants to know more about the inside of the whole world, not just their own inside too. And so, you know, it's why it's inspired all sorts of people, actually, whether they're religious or not. And they feel it's saying there's more, there's more, there's more. And yeah, Here's how to find out about that.
I mean, we live in a day today where obviously the Enlightenment and the sort of the progress of science, the success of science, really has caused a lot of people to kind of simply approach the world in naturalistic terms and say, you know, this is what we have. And, you know, as long as we can control our chemistry and biology, you know, we'll make the best of life and so on. But that still seems to leave a lot of people cold. They feel like, no, there's more, that's sort of dealing with a sort of shallow level at which life is lived. And so you've got the rise of, you know, even in the secular circles, I think a lot of people asking spiritual questions again. You know, goes without saying, people like Jordan Peterson and so on, who've you know, been at the forefront of this, but many others, and I come across them all the time. People who aren't satisfied, I suppose, with just jumping wholesale into a kind of specific religious worldview, but they're unhappy with the secular worldview at the same time. I mean, do you feel like Dante is maybe a bridge for someone like that, who's at that kind of a point in their life?
I hope so. I mean, I really do. And maybe what it does is it makes you realize that knowledge and truth isn't just objective, as if it can be sort of written on a page in a scientific or quasi-scientific way and made to kind of stack up. But actually, we know something's true when it resonates with us, when we participate in our hearts as much as in our minds with its truth. And so that's why imagination, it's why story, it's why experience is actually the primary source of truth. And Dante puts that absolutely in front of you and says, look, I did the same when I woke up in this dark wood, thought my life was in a complete mess, and it was. And yet it led me all this way. So I think that people like Peterson and others are realizing that earlier kind of new atheistic phase was just too literal when it comes to knowledge and truth. And it just feels a bit empty and even a bit noddy now. You know, they want more, and they know that life has got a kind of felt richness as well as an analytical richness, that reason and intelligence are about what you can absorb as much as what you can sort of pod and poke. Perception, again, is such light, and he gets drawn to the light all the time. You know, and what you can see is as much how you interpret what you see as much as just sort of putting it into a test tube and measuring it. Yeah, so this whole area of participation and truth is really opening up now, and figures in the public that people get drawn to, they sense it. That's why they watch all these blogs and YouTubes and things.
Well, thank you for producing this book. As I say, the 700th anniversary, I think, has literally just passed. I think it's around the 13th or 14th of September that marks the 700th anniversary of Dante's death. What sort of things are you seeing kind of come out to sort of mark this special occasion, apart from obviously the publication of your own very fine book, Mark?
Well, there's in Italy particularly, there's huge celebrations. Dante is the Italian Shakespeare. I mean, another part of his legacy was that he really makes modern Italian. There have been a whole bunch of different dialects around Italy before Dante, but he kind of brings it all together in his aftermath. And so he's absolutely seminal figure in Italy. But even in other parts of the world, there's kind of fans like me giving talks, and there's an exhibition, I know, at the Dante Society in London, for example. I think that, you know, with luck, perhaps because of this particular moment we find ourselves in, where we realise that these figures that came at the beginning of the modern period have got something which we can now revisit and make our own, because we sense that so much of what life is offering feels like it's emptied out a bit. And so returning to the kind of wellspring of our own times, if you like, which he lived in, it has great appeal, I hope and think.
Yeah, I heard someone say the other day, if you're reading more people who are alive than who are dead, then you need to change your reading list up. We need to get back to people like Dante, who, you know, 700 years on, we're still talking about what he wrote and the way it's impacted culture. But thank you so much. Dante's Divine Comedy, A Guide for the Spiritual Journey, is the book to go and check out. Mark Vernon is the author, and I'll make sure there's a link from today's show as well. But thanks for being my guest today, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to talk about.
And that brings us to the end of Unbelievable for this week. Thanks for being with me, Justin Brierley, here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Make sure to check out our show page for more from the programme. And look out next week. We're going to be releasing details of our very first online apologetics course. You're going to be hearing from some of the best speakers and being able to view some of the best speakers from Unbelievable, the conference over the years, and some personal tuition on apologetics on that online course. So look out for details of that same time next week. For now, thanks for being with me on today's show. All that's left for me to say is come back next week. We're continuing this mini series of ethical debates. We've had veganism, assisted suicide, next week abortion law, especially in light of this Texas law, the so-called heartbeat bill, outlawing abortion after 6 weeks. Joining me are Stephanie Gray, a leading pro-life advocate out in the US, and the Reverend Bromley McClenahan, a church leader in the USA who advocates for a pro-choice position. You can hear their discussion same time next week. See you then.